I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode, we're speaking to Louis Catupes about changing careers and becoming a chef in his 30s and about his journey to winning a chef's hat at Bar Rockford only a couple of years later. All right, welcome to another episode of the Food Fight podcast. My name's Steph Postuma, and with me as always, Simon Evans.
Yeah.
And we're in Canberra for this little whirlwind Canberra podcast trip, and for this episode, we are joined by Louis Catupes. How are you, mate?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us, and we're really looking forward to getting into a chat with you. But we start our podcast with an acknowledgement of country, and it's NAIDOC week, and we'd like to acknowledge that and acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, who are the traditional custodians of the land where we gather here in Canberra in this region today, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. All right, guys, let's kick off. For those who haven't heard of you, Louis, they've probably heard of Bar Rockford, which is the place that people most recognize your cooking from. Tell us a bit about, what's a good place to start? I guess I'll just tell the audience. Louis was the head chef at Bar Rockford for a time. How long?
About 2 years, approximately.
2 years,
yeah.
And you were there for when Bar Rockford won Bar of the Year.
Yeah.
That was the Delicious Awards, right? Or was it GT Awards?
No, it was Gourmet Traveller Bar of the Year, yeah.
Gourmet Traveller Bar of the Year, and you were also instrumental in getting a chef's hat there at Bar Rockford as well, which is an amazing achievement. Some might think that you need to have this illustrious career in European kitchens staging. You might be like Simon next to us here and slog it out as a head chef for a while in European kitchens, move to Australia, work in an established hatted restaurant, buy the restaurant, and then win the hats for yourself.
I thought you did it. This is it.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, that's all you have to do.
My plan from the start.
But your background in food, Louis, is completely different. So we should take it from the top, because we're going to talk about, I think what we'll sort of talk around in this podcast is traditional food and chef systems and what we look for, as well as the ways that you two both sort of share things in the way that you like to cook. But your story is a lot different. So tell us, like, how did you get into food, and we'll sort of work our way to becoming head chef at Rockford and what you're doing now.
Right. So I remember my first job, actually. I was in high school, and we did work experience. You sort of go and do, like, you know, 2 months going and helping someone out and just learning what it's like to not be in school, I guess. And I remember doing a couple of weeks with a local Greek restaurant in Petersham under Dave Tsourakis, who then had 1821 and has been involved in sort of a whole bunch of Sydney's Greek food stuff. I was my first job. I remember thinking, like, this guy's working some crazy hours, and it's like the expectation is the same food every night. And I remember thinking, I don't know I want to work those hours for that sort of level of sort of work-life balance. And I remember thinking, this isn't a career for me. I don't want to do it. So I ended up going and sort of studying and I studied political science, did a major in sort of international relations and economics, and then ended up in the public service for about 10 years. And it took me about 10 years to realize that I wasn't a very good public servant. And as much as I loved the issues that, you know, I got to work on, the actual work wasn't as rewarding as I think I was hoping it might be. I was at the end of sort of a long-term relationship, and we kind of went our separate ways. I ended up meeting someone and jumping on a plane and ending up in Paris. Not a whole bunch of plans beyond that, to be honest.
Best plan.
Yeah, it was pretty, in some ways I look back and it was pretty half-assed. There was no intention of sort of going and learning to be a chef out of that. But we were sort of trying to do a bit of food writing and a bit of food photography, and made some friends with a few chefs that were involved in this kind of bistronomy movement that was happening over there that I found really fascinating. And it was like a whole bunch of young kids, none of them French, doing some really cool, I wouldn't say experimental, and I wouldn't say fusion, because those words seem a bit dirty in sort of...
Yeah, it was more kind of, it was almost a backlash to a mix of the kind of Heston Blumenthal, exactly. Ferran Adrià, molecular gastronomy movement, which I think the kind of name kind of took a bit from that, and a bit of a go away from the traditional French with a nod to traditional French.
Yeah.
So it was interesting to see that little period of time where food was very much in kind of flux of what was considered popular food.
I think French cooking really had this moment about, I want to say, 5 to 10 years ago, things really started to change. It moved away from that really kind of stuffy white tablecloth silver service that Paris was really known for. Mm-hmm. And these guys sort of started selling up their restaurants, and they put all their really good skills they had to really, really good use. But they didn't have like, you know, 300 euro meals where it was like you felt like you had to mortgage the house to go and enjoy a decent feed. But there was also this middle ground that hadn't really been captured, because it was either the fine dining or it was the, you know, steak frites and, you know, duck à l'orange kind of stuff in every bistro you'd see on the street corner. So they'd find these old bistros, they'd take their cooking skills, and they'd still make it really accessible and really tasty, but it wasn't also sort of just trash kind of just, you know, frozen duck that they'd be getting, you know, you can get from anywhere. And then it started to move away from that and have these chalkboard menus where it was produce driven, really seasonal. You know, they'd work really closely with farmers and suppliers, and it sort of then started moving in its own direction, and it sort of attracted people from all over the world. I was working with an English guy, a Texan, and a Swedish guy, which I always think sounds like the beginning of a bad joke. But they all had these different techniques that all worked in, like Ed, the head chef, had worked in St. John's, so he had this whole nose-to-tail philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's really undone kind of style of plating that wasn't fussy, wasn't tweezer related. It was just like good flavors. I think his motto was like good food on shit plates. Mm-hmm. And it ended up looking really, really cool. It was really relaxed. And I made friends with him, and drunkenly one night offered to sort of come in and help him out because they were looking for someone. And I didn't have the right visas and stuff. So I just went in there for about 3 months and just worked for free to learn as much as I could. But after the first night, I remember him sitting down and saying like, why are you doing this? Do you want to be a chef? And I hadn't really thought about it. It just took me back to when I was a 14-year-old kid, thinking like back then I definitely didn't want to be a chef, and then thinking this is something I'm actually okay at. I remember just like it compared to being a public servant, where I'd sit down at my desk and someone would put something on my desk and be like, okay, I want you to do this, and I'm like, cool, I have no idea how to do that. And I walk into a kitchen and there was just something instinctively that felt easy and natural. And some people find that in the public service, some people find that gardening, some people find that, you know, in a doctor's surgery, whatever. For me, it happened to be a kitchen, and I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the process of coming up with flavors and combinations and just I wanted to learn everything. And he sat down and said, if you want to do this, you have to work harder than everybody else because you're 10 years behind. You have to read everything, because all the stuff you're going to learn from books, these guys learn in school and on the job. And someone at 24 that's 5 years younger than you knows 10 times more than you, so you're going to have to work really, really hard. So I just made the decision to stick with him and learn as much as I could over the next 3 months.
Can I stop you and take you back? What made you make the decision to want to work in that kitchen for free and to learn? Like, what was this? Was it just something about food that attracted you? Could you see something in your future? Or was it just like...
At that point, I don't really know. Like, when he asked me that question, I don't think I'd thought about changing careers per se. I was kind of in this point where I just broken up with my girlfriend of 10 years. I'd left my job. I didn't really know what the hell I was doing with my life. It felt like a midlife crisis, but it was happening at 30. And I just found this kind of like enjoyment being in a kitchen.
Right.
And
it's quite safe spaces in some ways.
Yeah.
Like, because it is regimented. It's there's also just, you know, good camaraderie. That there's some flair. Yeah. You have some creativity, but it is quite, you know, you show up this time, you do your jobs, you have your lunch, have your, you know, you have your drinks afterwards. Like, it is quite structured, and that's why I think a lot of almost no matter what age you are when you kind of get into chefing, most of the time people are looking for something, don't know what to do, or something's happened in their life, and it's kind of that moment of like, oh, kitchen seems like it's a laugh.
Mm.
Like, it's almost the same for everyone in that respect.
I can totally see the appeal, having worked like in kitchens and on other sorts of projects in offices and working in radio and that sort of thing. Especially coming from a public service background where the majority of your day you're probably on a computer and at your desk. And what I used to love about the kitchen is the sort of catharticness of when, not when you're under pressure, but prep time. And if you're just standing next to someone prepping for hours and just being able to chat and not necessarily being like having to have your mind like laser focused on, all right, how do I word something, or how do I got to send this email and figuring out my schedule. Mm. It's just like, all I'm doing for the next hour is like cooking this fucking shakshuka sauce or whatever I'm making. You know what I mean? Like chopping 20 kilos of onions and tomatoes. Mm. And making spice mixes and things like that. And it's such a different frame of mind to
a lot of
other types of work where you're just using your brain. You're just in your own head all the time.
I think it's funny. Like, I think this is a bit off topic, but it is related, I promise. I find like Canberra is divided essentially between public service and hospitality, and there's not a lot of interaction between those groups.
Mm.
And I think both of them, I wouldn't say there's a level of resentment, but I find people in hospitality, like, they kind of think that the public service is just a bit of a piss take. They think it's like, it's easy work, it's easy money,
mm.
you know, they're cashed up and all the rest of it. But I think what that doesn't recognize is that hospitality is dependent very, very much on public service for their customers. But I also think on the other side of it, the public service don't necessarily appreciate and understand what it's like in a kitchen. I think they might think that, you know, the number of people, I think there is a level of entitlement is what I guess I'm trying to say in the public service, when it's, and this is not trashing on public service, got a lot of people that are very good friends in that area. But in Canberra, I'd say 80% of the people that come through the door are public servants. And yeah. I think there's sometimes a level of like entitlement about what they expect, the kind of things they're going to get for the amount of money they're going to get. Mm. And they don't understand what it is like a lot of the time to be behind the scenes working the hours that you're working in a really, really hard industry in a really, really hard city. I mean, you're from Wollongong, small towns, I think, where we're just talking about supply chains before we sort of turn the mics on. Like supply chains, labor, like all of those things are magnified in smaller towns.
Yeah, it makes those little things tougher. Like small town, you might not be quite as busy as you in the city, but you've probably got three less chefs.
Yeah, exactly.
So it kind of all works out.
Mm. All right, let's go back to the story. We have to keep. Okay. I want to go chronologically. So
where do we get up to?
So your boss told you, you're going to have to work harder than everyone else. Yeah. And you've made the decision, I'm going to stick with this guy and I'm going to listen to him.
Yeah. And I think this also ignores another pretty significant person that sort of got me to this point. Like when I went to Paris, I went traveling with a woman that I'd met before I left, and we fell in love and went to Paris. And she was one of the biggest influences on me for food. She let me see food in a different way, forced me to see food in a different way. It was not just... There's a thing you hear in Canberra a lot, which is like, it's good for Canberra. And that pause really pisses me off, because it's just like, it's good or it's not. Like, when you start going to places and you start sort of saying it's good for, you know, it's good, but it's not that great. I've had better in Sydney. Accept the fact that it's not that good. And we should be striving for better. In Canberra, we have more restaurants and cafes than any other city per capita. And yet we still tolerate mediocrity.
I was saying this earlier. I was like, what's the population here? It's fucking, there's cafes and restaurants everywhere.
It's nuts. It's nuts. And I don't know why that is. I'm not sure if it's because it's a dispersed physical population, blah, blah, blah. Mm. We're getting off topic. But she forced me to look at things differently and say, like, if, you know, don't just accept that it's good or it's bad. Like, you know, see how it is. If you have a really great ice cream, a really great gelato in Sydney, or, you know, if you go to Italy, you go to Florence or whatever, you should be comparing that to, like, what you're having in Canberra to that, not just, like, whatever else you're having in Canberra. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
And I think her forcing me to look at food in a different way and then strive to be better than just being like, yeah, okay, that was good. Like, no, what can I do better? And I grew up in a house that was always like that. It was always like, you know, this is really delicious, but there was also then like three things you could do better next. Mm. So I was kind of, I had a bit of a thicker skin than, you know, than most, I guess, in that, and receiving that kind of feedback. But she's actually the one that got me this sort of 3 month, I don't want to call it a stage because it was in no way formal. Because
what was the restaurant called?
Au Passage.
Okay.
Actually made famous by Anthony Bourdain in No Reservations, I think.
I know of it.
Yeah.
Because of it.
Yeah. It was a flagship of that bistronomy movement. It just so happened that this guy, Ed, was working there. He was the head chef at the time. The previous head chef was a guy called James Henry, actually Canberra-born boy, who then grew up in Brisbane.
Yeah. I just remember reading about him when I first heard of the restaurant. However many years ago that was.
It's been around a while now. Yeah, and it was doing cool stuff. Like it was all natural wine. It was all, really simple chalkboard menu. It changed every night. And I just remember being really inspired by the chef's ability to change stuff. Like on a really busy night, I remember once I'd spent the whole day prepping like artichokes or whatever. And I'd been to the markets earlier that day with one of the chefs. And, you know, they had this rotating roster. Like everyone goes to the markets one day and they go and pick up the fresh stuff that, you know, this one particular guy would sell at one particular market once a week. And I was amazed because there were just like piles of edible flowers. And there were things that, you know, they're growing in everyone's backyard. But I'd never thought to really use those in dishes. But, you know, you have chefs that are, you know, they're going specifically to buy bunches of sage flowers and coriander flowers and all that kind of stuff. And we bought bags of artichokes and bags of like this really hot peppery mustard leaf. And halfway through the service that night, we ran out of a dish. And they just said to us, like, we need another veg dish. What have you got upstairs? One of the guys runs upstairs, come downstairs with an arm full of stuff, starts putting together a dish. And it was fantastic. It was super simple, really basic. It was just like whipped up goat's curd, preserved artichokes, some nigella seeds, and this wasabina flour. Mm. And it was just like, that was enough for it to be a dish that people then, we sold out of that dish that night, even though we only put it on halfway through the night. And that adaptability and flexibility and just like this innate understanding of flavors and dishes really made me think, like, this is what cooking is. This is what I want to do, rather than here's my list of prep jobs and a menu to follow every single day and every single night, and that's what I'm going to do for the next 10 years. Mm. And that made me think, like, this is really fun. We ended up staying actually at Ed's place. I ended up sleeping in their spare room for like, but definitely overstayed my welcome. Like, I just remember going to service and going to prep and then service, and then we'd come home and he'd be writing the menu for the next day that night. And he's like, we need another dish. And I was like, you know what? I keep on reading in the books, like, you know, lamb's brains and stuff like that. I'd really like to learn how to cook them. And he'd just call up and order them. They'd get 12 lamb's brains the next day, and it was on the menu that night. And I was like, holy shit, this is cool.
Try calling up the butcher in Australia and ask for 12 lamb brains.
Tell me about it. It's crazy. Yeah. It's just... It's such a different environment, but it actually made me see what cooking could be.
Mm.
And I think the other aspect of that I hadn't touched on yet was it wasn't just French cooking. It definitely was not French cooking. It was bringing stuff from, and that was the beauty of bistronomy, it was bringing stuff from all different cuisines and techniques and all that kind of stuff. Like, I think there were Japanese ingredients on every single menu I saw.
Mm.
Clown bar is like an institution of bistronomy over there. And their signature dish, they have two signature dishes. One of them is like duck pithiva, which is like a French version of a pie, I guess you could describe it as.
Fancy pie.
Yeah. and the other one is calves brains in tomasu, which is like a Japanese like dashi citrus broth and gremolata on top. And that's it. And I think if you try to serve something up like that in Sydney or Canberra.
That thing is the most like... unapologetic brain on a plate. It, like,
no
you've ever seen.
It just looks like a brain in soup. And it's, it's fantastic. And like, I don't know. I think incorporating those kinds of ingredients, not just like, you know, Japanese ingredients, but also like more sort of nose to tail, and we're going on a different topic here, but nose to tail kind of produce became something that I really, really embraced and wanted to sort of try and do here. But I think Australia is actually really well positioned from a bistronomy point of view, because you're not bound by, you know, this is a Chinese restaurant or it's an Italian restaurant. We have such a broad palate, so much more broad, I think, than Paris. Like, you can incorporate much more South American stuff, Southeast Asian stuff, things that don't have a really big footprint over there.
Mm.
We just have such a bigger melting pot.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, like fusion food for lack of a better term, is just can just happen a lot more naturally here. Not where you're like,
well, you just have to stop saying the word fusion.
Well, yeah, but it's got a bad name because people were going like, let's do Spanish and German food, and it will have a Spanish German name, and they were going out.
Don't.
They were going out specifically to make this new food. When it like only fusion, it's like you just bring in a bit of that from there,
just and grabbing a bit of stuff.
And Australia's great for that, where like a lot of compared to like UK, sort of Asian ingredients are staples of almost every kitchen in this country. Mm. Where if you bought in some dashi or you made a little dashi or something else, that would be considered your little Asian dish you put on the menu rather than just being like something you use.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So yeah, like so here is kind of primed for that.
Yeah,
that type of eating. The only problem I think then is they don't really have the history here of that nose to tail eating.
That's true.
That's what they lack in Australia massively.
Let's get on to that because we'll talk about a lot of things, but we want to keep going with your story, Louis. Mm. So was it 3 months total?
Yeah, it was about 3 months. We were in Paris for 5, and we're actually supposed to go traveling more broadly.
Yeah.
And we ended up just getting stuck in Paris for me. So that was...
Yeah.
Can be boring for, you know, your partner in crime. But there was 3 months there. There were kind of a couple of trips, side trips here and there to rural France and that kind of thing.
And then back to Canberra.
Yeah. So back to Canberra. It was back to Sydney immediately. I remember when we were overseas, Fidor started open. I was in the process of opening, so I was following them as closely as I could because it looked awesome. Mm. We went for dinner in there and happened to have a connection to the floor manager, so I ended up having a chat to him and got a trial and ended up doing a couple of weeks working for Lennox at Fidor, which was amazing. I wish I'd had more of a chance to stay there, but for a whole bunch of other personal reasons I won't go into, I needed to be back in Canberra.
Mm.
I needed to be working on a few things for myself and for my partner. And I ended up not being able to stay that long, but that is in Fyodor, but that has been a really, really big imprint on me. I think Lennox's approach to cooking was, I still sort of wish I'd had more time there to cook with him or for him, because he was just such a talented cook and such an amazing use of technique.
Mm.
That is both like fine dining and really, really rustic approach to cooking, which I just love. But anyway, came down to Canberra periodically, but it wasn't until I came down here and I think I was having a coffee at Barrio and met one of the chefs who was about to sort of be involved in opening of Rockford and had a chat to them and ended up sort of backwards and forwards as like, yeah, there's a job. No, there's not a job. Yeah, there's a job. And eventually the job that came up when Nick was sort of just about to open was... it was kind of part-time dishy, couple of kitchen shifts, and as long as I was willing to bring a change of clothes and wait the tables and sometimes work the door on a Friday and Saturday night, I could have a job. So I started there. So I was washing dishes Tuesday through Thursday and doing some prep on the stove with Ian Poy, who'd worked at 86 most prominently in Canberra. And a guy called Nagesh, who is down in Melbourne now doing some Mauritian pop-ups, which are really cool.
You see.
Mm.
And then eventually, so Friday, Saturday, I'd work the floor. So I learned a little bit about wine, but forgotten most of it now. and then I remember working, when we were really busy early in the sort of the piece, I was, because I was like the tallest person there. For anyone listening, I'm like 6'6", so could transfer from the kitchen to the stand-in bouncer every now and then pretty easily. So that was there were some late nights on Fridays and Saturdays when we were busy then, when Rockford was still very early days. Eventually, the head chef, Ian, left, and there was a new head chef that came in, and that didn't last sort of too long. Then Nagesh and I took over as head chefs towards the end of 2016. We sort of did just the two of us doing the whole thing. About 3 or 4 months later, I'd just come back from a brief trip to Japan. Nagesh was moving on to focus on some study and do some other things. And Nick offered me if I wanted to be the head chef, if I wanted to roll, it was mine.
Mm.
So I look back at some of the dishes we're putting up then. I was like, oh man, I wish, you know, I think it's always the case. You look back at it and you go, man, I wish I'd known what I know now. But it was a very steep learning curve for me. And I think, we worked our asses off for... That was the year, actually, 2017 that year was when we got the Gourmet Traveller Bar of the Year.
Mm.
It was a really subdued night, actually, when we got that award, because they only gave Nick one ticket, so the poor guy had to go to Sydney by himself. It was like a Thursday night or something. And we were pretty quiet. And then, you know, we hadn't heard anything from Nick, and sort of sending a message like, what's going on? What's happening? And he sent us a photo of the plate. And he was plastered. Like, you could tell by his eyes at that point. He was holding, apparently got it and just ran straight to the bathroom to take a photo of it by himself. He was so stoked. And we were so excited.
That's amazing.
Hooting and hollering all around the bar and popping champagne, and there were like the 15-20 customers that were there that night. I had no idea what was going on.
Yeah. Did when, you know, Nick first opened and, you know, during your time there, I remember when Rockford was first opening, it was really always just like people knew it as a wine bar in its first few months, and there wasn't this focus on the food. Was the level that you brought the food to something that Nick had in mind from the start, or was it something that you just kept pushing as the head chef and it just got to where it was naturally?
I think it was a bit more organic. I think it took a little while to get where we wanted it to be. And I mean, to be fair to sort of where it started, like the food was good when we started. There's no doubt about that. It was just a much more pared back menu. Someone dug up one of the first menus we had and we were amazed at how small it was. It was very small, but it was still meticulously put together. And I think within the first couple of months, that food was still getting pretty good ratings within Canberra, which was pretty cool. But because it had that reputation as a bar, people didn't really consider us for a food venue. I mean, the opening line of one of the first review we ever got was about how hard it was to find because it was a wine bar upstairs. Yeah. And that was a food review in the Canberra Times. It was like, it's not really the point, and it's not massively helpful to be sort of focusing on that. But
the media will get you.
Yeah. But I mean, I think Nick had always wanted it to be small share plates and that kind of thing. And I think, you know, it would have been a really great vibe, but it organically moved beyond that. And I think when we were sort of super quiet on a Tuesday and a Wednesday and stuff, we started to look at it more and think, how do we make this a more not successful, but a more kind of like engaged business, so people kind of start to think about us differently. And we realized that Fridays and Saturdays, we were going to be heaving no matter what.
Yeah.
Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, we needed to sort of recalibrate it to make people think of it as a restaurant a bit more. And that's when we started to really focus on expanding the menu, giving people what they wanted, so the people could come and sit at the bar and have like the snacks and whatever, but people could also come and have a full meal, not just snacks, with, you know, their mum and dad, is the way Nick always liked to put it, or they'd come out and, you know, an approachably affordable but tasty and kind of like, I don't want to say challenging, but, you know, not just your run-of-the-mill kind of pub food is what we definitely didn't want to do. And then eventually it started to get a bit more recognition for the food. It took a lot of time, and it was really hard to staff at that point because we weren't considered a restaurant. No one really wanted to come and work there in the kitchen because they didn't think, you know, they weren't going to learn anything. I'm not qualified as well, so I can't take on apprentices, which is a really, really tough part of this industry because, you know, young kids who might want to work and learn those kinds of things, I can't give them their qualification sign off because I don't have one myself. That made it hard again, but yeah, it was, I think, a bit more organic than sort of like, this is what we're aiming for, this is what we're doing. It kind of happened as we sort of realized what the business needed to be and needed to become to be successful and to sort of fill those shoes of the bar I wanted to be.
How did you go about, so like, I think there's two sides to being a head chef for sure. Like, well, there's many sides, Simon, you can speak to it. But there's the creative side and the cooking side, and then there's the logistical side. And like, I feel like experience in leadership roles in kitchens is what allows you to learn how to roster and write menus and order and implement systems and that sort of thing. Like, you know, let alone learning new techniques and all that stuff that you didn't have in, you know, in early in your career.
Really, like, you don't get taught how to roster. You get taught a cost a little bit, but like, you forget about that.
That's way reflective of reality.
Yeah, they don't teach you how to lead a team, how to run a kitchen. Yeah.
But what I mean is like, you learn that in your leadership role, like as soon as you start working in your kitchens.
No, you really don't. It's very hard to get taught that. Like, I used to always be, all the kitchens I worked at was very curious, and I'd always ask questions about these things because I was pretty ambitious. I mean, like, I think I started late at 22 compared to a lot of chefs in the UK who started at 16 and and we're in, you know, Michelin star kitchens at 17. So I felt like I had a bit of catching up to. So I had a very kind of clear goal. I wanted to own a restaurant, be a head chef by the time I was 30, win a Michelin star by the time I was 30, all these things. So I was quite on it, and I was asking these things and asking to see these things and asking how my bosses did stuff. But it wasn't like it was forthcoming. And it'd be very rare to find a head chef who would go out of his way to try and teach these things because you're fucking busy. Mm. And, you know, first years at Caveau, there was no involvement in, and not even menu planning, really. It was do your fucking job.
Mm.
So you don't really learn those things. So realistically, I think there's an advantage of having some life experience and working other jobs. Even with me working for 6 years before I became a chef in various different things, where you've got just a little bit extra confidence, you're a little bit older, you can take things in better, and there's probably an advantage for those administrative things from doing something else, and even just from being able to talk to your suppliers. Like, people who've been in a kitchen since they're 16 are a bit fucked socially. Like, it takes its toll when you're older and you spent like 4 or 5 years and you're like, fuck, I used to be friendly to people. Yeah. Like, I remember that. I always used to talk to strangers. Like,
So you just kind of learnt that sort of side of things on the fly in the kitchen there, and just figured out how to cost things out, how to order, you know, like...
I think I'd been given a kind of rough idea about how much things should cost. But I also think you sort of learn on the job and on the fly, I guess, you know. On the job and on the fly, I feel like sometimes you're a little bit different, because like, you learn on the job over experience. You're going to take quite a long time to get to that kind of level of understanding about how to do things properly and professionally and respectfully. On the fly, you have to learn how to do things like...
right then and there.
Yeah, yeah. Like, and the number of things I think that people don't realize in kitchens that are held together with like what feels like crazy glue and chewing gum. Like, it's so much stuff is just like, does that work? Yep, cool, let's go, we're starting service right now. I think I completely agree with you about sort of life experience being really, really helpful. That's not to say the kids that grow up in kitchens being really young aren't good. Like, there's some fantastic chefs in Canberra that have come up through, like, they've been working in kitchens since they were 14. You look at Mal Hanslow and Pilot.
Yeah,
like, he was washing dishes out in Bungendore when he was 14, and he's gone on to do some pretty amazing things, I think, in Canberra. I come from a completely different perspective, and I think Mal and I have very different life experiences and very different approaches in some ways. That's not to say one's better or worse than the other, but you learn things differently based on your personality, where you're working, all that kind of gear. Like, when you said the costing stuff, I was given a rough ballpark. I mean, I'm not sure if you learned the same thing. It was like, costings are like 35%, which is now, I think, completely out of the...
Yeah, you're like, keep it around here, and that's
right.
It. Yeah. But I mean, and the, like, cost, it's very hard to get costing down.
Mm.
Like, you have to be very organized and very, very on top to have your costing down to, like, you know, the cents, like 10 cents. Like, you have an idea, you're like, well, this is an expensive ingredient, that's expensive, what does that add up to? Okay, cool.
I mean, I've
generally worked in a tasting menu thing as well, so it's always a balance of you know,
across the whole
seven
thing.
To 10 dishes, and you can go like, you're like, oh fuck, I'm using magpie goose, what's the cheapest fish I can get for this fish?
Yeah, exactly. And I think you've also then got to say, you know, what is a realistic amount that people would pay for this dish?
Yeah.
You could cost a dish out and say, like, you know, for example, I want to chuck pigeon on my menu every now and again.
Yeah.
You try and get a costing on a pigeon, like, a wholesale price on something like that is, I think, $28 is what I was given. And it's like, the average costing for someone that doesn't know costing is listening to this, you wouldn't be able to charge anything less than $100 for a bird that's smaller than a quail. And it's like, that's absurd. That's absolutely nuts. So you have to say, realistically, what is someone going to pay for this dish? And you make up things here and there. Mm. So your markups might be like vegetables, for example. People feel really satisfied when they have vegetables, especially if they're done in interesting and different ways.
Yeah.
But the markups on vegetables are, I feel like I'm letting this sort of like a whole bunch of secrets out here right now, but the markups on vegetables are astronomically higher than proteins. Your protein margins are razor thin. But you've also got to understand, for respect for the customer, what are they going to pay without gouging them?
Mm.
But they've also got to then recognize on the other side of it how much goes into running a business like this and not having wastage, making sure your guys are paid properly and have, you know, a good work-life balance, and making sure also that the suppliers are being paid properly, because you know, you can always go cheaper,
but
you shouldn't necessarily. Yeah. Like, you know, if you're doing local suppliers, just because it's local doesn't mean it's cheaper. Oftentimes it's more expensive, but you know the quality is going to be better. and you know it's not going to have chemicals pumped into it. You know that, you know, Joe Bloggs, who milks his cows, isn't going to be, you know, being run out of the family business by one of the major supermarket chains, but they're just downward pressure on sort of wholesale prices. If you want to do this job, I think, ethically, sustainably, and all that kind of stuff, and again, totally new topic here.
Yeah, let's get to it later.
You need to sort of be prepared as a customer and a restaurant owner that things are going to cost money. They just do.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. We're going to get to local. We're going to get to sustainability and all those sorts of things. It's very easy for us to go off on tangents, but let's talk about when you won the hat. That was 2000 and was that last year? 19 or 18?
18. 18 was the first. Yeah.
Tell us about that, because I mean, someone who'd been cooking for how many years at the time?
Three
years.
Think, yeah.
And you won a hat at Bar Rockford in Canberra. It's just one bar of the year. Like, I mean, even now, like it's a very, very well recognized establishment now. Like everyone who knows anything about food in Australia and happens to be in Canberra wants to check it out. What was that like? Did you expect it? Like, you know, did you think that you were? I mean, you would have got an invitation, obviously, but like, you know.
That was pretty nice. Actually, I didn't actually go to the awards.
Yeah.
Because they sent us two tickets, and Nick and I both bought flights, and we were sort of really looking forward to going. And we were like, okay, you know, maybe this is a hat, maybe it's not, blah blah blah, and then. Then this letter, this email came through saying we'd been nominated for the Fairfax Bar of the Year as well for their competition. And I immediately thought, okay, we don't have a hat. We've gone up there because of this nomination, which is, you know, that's fantastic. So I immediately said to Nick, I think I'm not going to go, but I think you should, like Lucas should take my ticket, because he was the up-and-coming I don't know if he was the sommelier at the time, but he was the floor manager and had a really big hand in the wine selection. And he's now working at Aubergine as the somm and doing a fantastic job for, like, he's not for, this isn't a for camera kind of comment. He's young and incredibly talented. And he's doing some really fantastic stuff in wine. And I said, you know, if this is about the bar award, I think it's more important that Lucas goes and gets some recognition for what he does. And my parents had just come back from a trip overseas, so I just thought, you know, let's go and have dinner, let's have a nice nice meal, have a glass of wine and a hot bowl of pho or something like that. And as we pulled up in the car park, I got a phone call from Lucas to say that we hadn't got the bar award, but we had got the hat. So we sat down to our Vietnamese dinner, and Mum and Dad couldn't help but tell everybody in the restaurant, including the owner, that that we just got a hat, and asked for the most expensive bottle of champagne, which I think came out at about $14.
Nice. Yeah.
It was fantastic. It was a really good time, and I think people then really started to kind of recognize as a restaurant what we were kind of trying to do, not just like... And it's not denigrating in any way what's going on at Rockford in terms for the wine, because it is fantastic. It's one of the best places for your wine selection in Canberra, I reckon. But it meant that people started to see us a bit more, a bit differently as a restaurant and somewhere you could go for a late night drink as well.
But how did that feel for you as the chef, as someone who'd been cooking for 3 years? Be like,
it was bananas.
Holy fucking shit. Like, what's going to happen now? I'm going to have critics coming in, all sorts of people. I've bloody been working in the kitchen for 3 years. What am I doing?
It was terrifying. It was genuinely terrifying. And it's still, for me, this really weird novelty. You got to pinch yourself every now and again, I think, when you realize you take it for granted after a while because it's just your bread and butter. But when people sit down and pay money to eat the food you're cooking, for me, it's still weird. Like, we all started cooking, you know, scrambled eggs and sort of cakes at home and whatever. But then... when people make reservations and you have to get to a point you're like, I'm really sorry, I can't fit you in this week because we're booked out, and you're like, shit, people actually genuinely enjoy this. This isn't some kind of like fad. This isn't just a fluke. It's such a weird feeling. I don't think you ever really get over it. You kind of have to take a step back to fully appreciate it sometimes. But it's a pretty special feeling, I think, that people actually enjoy what you're doing and want to,
It's a ultimate recognition in Australia for chefs, really. But you do, like, the thing being is you know if you actually turn up to the awards, you go there, you listen all this out, like all the big guys get up, make a speech, you get pissed, and then two years later you're back in work doing the same thing.
Exactly.
And you're back to it for another year, and then and you've got X amount of time to do, you think they're going to review again, and then you've got X amount of time until the next thing. So you kind of just forget about it. And if you're working that level is sort of your baseline.
Yeah.
So you're just like, well, that's like, for me, it's quite bad the way I think about it. I'm like, well, yes, Of course I got a hat. That's the level I work at. And that's how I kind of go throughout the year of trying to keep that standard. Because that's how you've got to be to keep that standard up.
Yeah.
If you think that's the pinnacle of it, you're only going to drop below.
There is a level of pressure over keeping it up that I think is really difficult for chefs as well. Like where you lose a hat or that sort of pressure of maintaining one.
Yeah.
There is a bit of fear behind that. I remember going to sort of, you know, ceremonies and awards and that kind of stuff. And you come back and you're like, you're on cloud nine.
Mm.
And then the next day of service you have, you're dead. And you're like... I think after the hat and the GT awards are all in like September, and I don't know if it's like this at any elsewhere, but September is notoriously like the shittest month of service. It's, and all I can put it down to is warming temperature, so people want to drink and eat outside, but footy season. It's AFL and league grand finals. And if you're working somewhere like Rockford, which is a bar with no television screens, thank Christ, I mean, love it footy, but people don't want to come and hang out in September in a bar where they can't watch the final season.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's a really big challenge when you go to these, like, you know, these ceremonies where it's like, this is really great, instead of rubbing shoulders with people, and then you come back and you're like, okay, cool, we're going to get railed tonight.
Yeah, the discernible difference isn't really there. It's not that thing you hear about, oh, they want a hat, and the next day the phone line to be disconnected because there's so many people wanted to get in.
Yeah.
I think people, like, it takes a couple weeks for people to, like, realize, and it'll be announced in the paper, and they're like, oh.
Hmm.
And I mean, in some ways, especially for a bar that maybe wasn't known for food so much, it could be a reason people don't go, because people have that idea of a hat restaurant is a fancy restaurant.
Yeah.
So we can have that double-edged sword. We probably noticed that with Cavo a lot as we tried to make it a bit more casual, a bit more accessible. And I think we did that in the way our service, our food, and the way the place looked. But we're always going to have that tag of the fancy, expensive restaurant. Mm.
Did you ever have people coming in, like, lamenting what Cavo used to be? Did that ever happen to you guys?
Yeah, for sure. Luckily, like I said, it had a kind of a slow, natural change over the years. So there wasn't too many people who were like, oh, I loved it when it was very traditional French. We still did. Yeah. But realistically, they probably just didn't come back.
Yeah, yeah.
So they might have come in once and said this, that, and the other. We didn't have too many people go like, oh, it was much better when other guys had it.
Yeah.
Well, not to our face anyway.
People struggle with change with those kinds of things. I find.
I think it was lucky because Tom and I, his partner, we've both been there for a while. We were both, between us two and another chef, we were all sort of left to get on with that kitchen for the last 18 months before we actually bought it. That people sort of knew it was us there, and we did change things fairly slowly or progressively.
Yeah.
So there was never too much of a jump, but definitely the way we wanted to take the place was kind of held back with the 15-year history of it being a fancy French restaurant, and we were doing, then it's a Welsh guy doing modern Australian food in a restaurant with a French name. So like it was quite confusing, and the way people think can hold you back, even to the point you're saying where trying, like, being known as a bar and trying to get people to eat, that's a very hard thing to balance, and not many places in Australia do it well. Like there's a handful in Sydney, handful in Melbourne, Adelaide. Like, so there's not that many who, there's not many hatted wine bars in Australia.
I think for a long time there's still this perception that, like you were saying, that hatted restaurants are, linen tablecloths and it's a different kind of level of service that people tend to expect. And I think as dining predominantly moves away from that kind of thing, I would hope that people's expectations start to change. And I don't know, one of these things I think that might come out of COVID, if one good thing comes out of COVID for hospitality, it's going to be hopefully expectations change about what dining is and how much it costs. And then, because if you want to do the fine dining kind of stuff, again, we're coming back to a cost thing, but it is so much more expensive to do. It's so much more wasteful. And that's one of the reasons the prices are so high. But now we're at this point where it's like, okay, we have limited places. We need to make money, and we need to be able to pay guys. And we want to give you guys the best experience possible. And I don't know that fine dining necessarily... It definitely has a place in dining, and it always will. But I think it's not going to explode in the way that it might have
'90s. I think it will take that final evolution. I think in Australia especially, I mean, UK and Europe, you still get a lot of, like, most Michelin star places are still as very pompous white tablecloth places. Australia's moved on a bit more, but I think, let's say COVID would be that last step for people who that kind of level of fake luxury that used to be fine dining, I think it's just going to take another step away from that. I mean, we're already getting there, like, you know, like Attica, they don't have tablecloth, like, think like the tablecloth is almost like the synonymous thing with fine dining, and you're seeing less and less tablecloths. Expensive to fucking have tablecloths.
I also think though, like the casual, I hate this label as well, because casual fine dining has such a broad range of things it can be. But I feel like the quality of food and the like the ambition that the chefs are really punching for in that bracket has improved so dramatically that it's caught up in a lot of the ways. Like a lot of the Emperor's New Clothes stuff with fine dining has almost been lifted, and everyone's like, we can do that.
Yeah.
We just don't have to charge, you know, $300 a head for you to be able to eat it. We can put that on a plate and have this sort of much more relaxed sort of environment.
Yeah, exactly. Especially save money on tablecloths.
It's just that much more.
Thousands of dollars a year, save fucking tablecloths.
But it makes fucking it so much more accessible. Napkins. Yeah, exactly. And I think as the quality of food has come up and people feel much more relaxed and comfortable when I hate it when someone sits down at the table with me to explain stuff, but that doesn't mean it has to be ma'am and sir the whole night.
Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it can be a conversation. And I think it's taken all those great things that fine dining did have, and is it attentiveness, knowledge, obviously great food, great wine, the slickness, the speed, the being able to make someone have a great night. They're the things that we keep.
Yeah, totally.
They're the things that are kept. It's just the stuff that's wasted. Like again. Tablecloths, napkins. Putting the napkin on your lap. Like, everyone can do that themselves. Even like, you know, it's a fucking 2019 rosé. There's no need to taste that to check if it's faulty. Like, you don't need these things. We can get rid of them. We can focus on what's actually important, what actually makes a great meal.
Exactly.
Louis, let's finish your story and we can go off on another tangent and we'll finish off with more other stuff. You're in a sort of a post Rockford world now. When did you decide to finish up? Sort of why, and what do you want to next? Obviously, I'm assuming COVID sort of threw a spanner in the works of your plans.
It was COVID was a funny one. I
start with finishing up at Rockford.
Okay, I remember one of the other parts of 2018 was I got a nomination for Gourmet Traveller.
Best new talent.
Yeah. And Nick and I did a road trip up. Road trip's probably generous, but we drove to Sydney.
Yeah.
and we had a big long chat on that drive up. And on the drive back, we ended up crashing at my sister's place and we're horribly hungover for the drive home. Incidentally, that I was sitting opposite Ben Shuri and Matt Lindsay, and I think Clayton Wells was on the. It was the weirdest table to sit at, and I'm just like, what the fuck? Like, am I at the wrong table? But anyway, we ended up having a big long chat on the way home, and we'd sort of had these on and off conversations about, you know, what was going to happen next and that kind of stuff. But over the course of the drive back to Canberra, we'd sort of said, look, first quarter of this year, because it was so full on. Like, we had so many staffing problems. I was completely burnt out, and it had been a fantastic year. But I think we both, I sort of said to him, like I think I want to sort of take a bit of a break come first, like the end of the first quarter of 2019. And I don't know what will happen after that. So I think it's probably best to presume that I won't come back. We'll sort of plan a transition. And if I do come back, I come back. If I don't, I don't. And, you know, whatever. And we're all, you know, It was a very kind of, you know, amicable conversation. And then when it did come time to leave, I ended up going traveling a little bit, which was heaps of fun. We went to Myanmar and Hong Kong, and then came back, did a pop-up with the dudes from Paperbark, so Joey and Lucy. And then I went, basically hopped back on a plane and went to Taiwan and back to Paris to see the guys that I used to work with. And Ed needed some help in his new restaurant. So I did a week sort of mucking around with him. It was actually really fun, with no pressure of coming up with a menu, but still sort of like running out of shit halfway through. I'd gone from the kid that was just like wide-eyed and amazed at these guys that were coming up with stuff on the fly to being at a point where, you know, 5 o'clock.
You can hold it down with them.
Yeah, well, 5 o'clock, they're like, what's our fifth veg dish? And you're like, I saw a box of this downstairs, and, you know, what's the rest of the dish? And you just throw a couple of ingredients at them, and there was your menu item. That felt... like, it had almost felt full circle. And I was like, I feel like I've not made it, but I feel like I'm where I wish I was.
At least caught up.
Yeah.
You've done the reading.
Yeah, it was good fun. I'd sort of, the reading paid off.
Yeah.
But I think when I came back, I was like, okay, I'm now ready to start cooking again. This was about a 6-month sort of interim. And I just spent every day writing menus and designing places and looking at vacant sites and that kind of stuff. And about this time last year, actually, I approached some people who had a vacant coffee shop in Kingston, which for anyone not listening or doesn't, sorry, anyone not that doesn't know Canberra is like an old part of Canberra that had heaps of coffee shops and that kind of thing back 10, 15 years ago and then just kind of died in the arse a little bit. So there's a whole bunch of vacant places there and I just hit these guys up for the, if they wanted to sort of sublease me the coffee shop for 6 months over summer. And we pulled the team together and didn't do any changes. It looked horrible. The place looked, it looked like a Subway, fuck the licorice, all sort is what I always described it as. It was a very, very bad fit out. So we just took it on, didn't do any substantive changes and just started rolling 3 weeks after we approached them.
And that was called Kiosk.
Yeah, it was. The whole point of the name obviously was that it was just a very temporary kind of space, but it's kind of stuck and people kind of really seem to want to see it come back. But it was trying to see if that suburb would work for the kind of restaurant and the food I wanted to do. If there was a market for that kind of, you know, wine and sort of service and that kind of thing, because I realized there wasn't that, again, casual fine dining offering in Kingston. And it took a little while, but, you know, as soon as we actually had, I think we had three solid weeks where it was like no bushfires and no pandemic, because the bushfires in Canberra were just appalling. You'd have maybe an hour of service before this just blanket of smoke would just fall. Wow. I mean, I can't imagine what it was like in Wollongong. We didn't have fires directly in Canberra. Well, airport we did, but it was just...
We actually lucked out in Wollongong.
Really?
Yeah, there was only a couple of days where there was smoke ahead.
Had a lot of smoke and stuff like that, but the closest they got was Nowra, basically.
It just didn't wash across us.
We
were very lucky.
We were just blanketed in smoke for months. It was awful. And then I think as soon as that lifted, there's a hailstorm that came through. I'm not sure if you remember that one.
The legendary
still see the cars driving.
2019.
They finally got around to doing Kingston's rooftops again because everyone lost their tiles and whatever.
They'll just write your car off straight away, apparently.
Yeah.
That's what the rumors I heard yesterday.
My car was written off. My parents had driven down the day before to help me do some work on the place from Sydney, and they lost both front and back windscreens, had their car written off, had to drive back with Glad wrap on the back window.
So Kiosk, though, was the food...
Are we finished
how similar was the food at Kiosk to what you were doing at Rockford? Did you sort of, after these travels, like obviously having a bit of time to sit down and think about what you were doing next, was it like, I need to figure out what type of food I want to do? Because obviously what we're sort of talking here is like eventually looking to find a place for yourself and something permanent. And this is the point where... Like it's, you know, you're able to sort of continue to develop what you want to do and having the food that you want to cook.
I would say it's more of a natural progression than rather a hard break.
Yeah,
I guess like it still was very still casual, still produce driven. We would change and flip the menu halfway through. Like we didn't have any storage at all. We had no cool room and no dry store. We had a couple of underbench fridges. So if we knew we only had say 5 spatchcock left at the end of the night, rather than buying another 20 spatchcock, we'll be like, okay, what are we flipping that to halfway through service? We're either changing the dish completely or we're going to just change the protein and make sure that everything is going to still taste good. So we had to prep. We could only really prep one day in advance, max. And if we got absolutely slammed one night, we'd have to come up and rewrite the menu for the next day. I really wanted to try that aspect of it. So the food, I guess, itself, I tried to sort of take maybe to a... I wanted to improve on my technical skills, which is something not going to school, I never really learned from someone that was just like, this is what you need to do this, like to the very kind of regimented sort of cooking school kind of way of learning. I wanted to sort of take it up a notch and make it 100% restaurant focused rather than like we're a restaurant in a bar. And I think you have to do certain things differently. You can't have like bar snacks. You can't have as many kind of snack type things if you want to make money in that kind of venue, because people are just going to sit on a bowl of chips and a glass of wine all night. So we needed to up the ante a little bit. And I think I really wanted to solidify my style. And I think that, again, happened kind of organically through the ingredients I liked using. And I'd sort of start to notice more and more things like miso and dashi would end up on my menu and that kind of stuff. It wasn't until I took a step back and realized that's what's happening, I think. But I still don't want to use fusion as the kind of way to describe it. It was
it's very hard to like have your own style in cooking without just lots of trial and error of menus. Like it's very hard to go like, I think I'm going to start doing my food like this more, or I'm going to start plating everything in this sort of style. Like it is really just trial and error. And then occasionally you get new ingredients, or you like read or see a new technique and you chuck that, and that kind of that just becomes something in your back pocket.
Yeah. And I think building on that kind of stuff, like I had a repertoire I could use of both techniques and flavors from Rockford. And I wanted to sort of expand that into different things I picked up from travel or reading, and allow me to focus on kind of the things like I wanted to pursue. Because I think for me, I want to learn stuff. I get more kicks out of that than I do out of service. And I know that's not normal for most chefs. I think chefs like really enjoy the adrenaline of service a lot of the time. I kind of like the learning part of it most. I like discovering things or figuring things out. Or my happiest moment is when I sort of figure out a new combination, put it on a plate, and go, "That's fucking delicious. I can go home now." But, you've also got 5 more hours of service, so you can't. But,
see everyone.
Yeah, yeah. I'm out. Mic drop. See you, bye. But, like, that kind of stuff I really enjoy. And having your own place where, like, Rockford was great, but it also had its own parameters. I wanted to sort of work with things like chicken hearts. But if I ever tried to put brains on, like, chicken hearts I got on the menu a couple of times. Just
You can just about push them.
Yeah. Brains,
maybe not.
I'd never put brains. I love, like, lamb's brains are... They're
incredible.
They're delicious. They do a bit fuck around the prep time, but like they're super tasty. And most people, once they eat them, would be like, "Oh, that's pretty good." At minimum, like they're delicious. But I was never brave enough to put them on.
Yeah, and I think at a place like Rockford, it'd be really challenging to sort of justify the expense and the labor and the effort to put that on. But with Kiosk, I had a bit more freedom to sort of pursue a restaurant focus of it, some of the ingredients and the techniques to be able to do that.
If it's your own theme, it's on you.
Exactly.
Yeah, when we were putting fucking magpie goose and like we didn't serve any hooved animals for like 18 months. And that was like quite a risk.
Like, that is.
Like, so we did that because no one was going to tell us we couldn't. So we thought it was a good idea, and we're like, we're still open. So we just kind of rolled with that for a bit. And so once it's on you're a bit more free to be like, like a minimum, we'll try it. Like, if I'll try on the menu, if it doesn't sell, I won't do it again. I've lost, a couple hundred bucks. And that's a risk like I've always been willing to take with my food.
I think having your own place gives you the opportunity. Like I learned so much in the space of 5 months. Like apart from the there was so many challenges we had to overcome. There was, like I said, the bushfires, there was hailstorm we got broken into. Then COVID hit, and I feel like we were just finding our feet at that point. But like, you learn so much running your own business. It's not just about how to manage people and how to manage suppliers. It's about how to balance your books and all that kind of stuff. I went into that venue partly wanting to expand my repertoire and learn more about cooking, but also to learn how to run a business on my own. And I feel like I got a masterclass in that. Like, I'm not far from perfect, and I wish I'd still had that place to be able to keep learning. But having have a clean cut of it and look back at it and go like, okay, I learned a lot of lessons. The next time I sign a lease on a place and start recruiting guys, I know what I'm going to do differently now. And that was a really, really productive 6 months from that point of view alone, let alone, sort of the cooking side of things as well. That was an incredible experience for that.
I'm going to change direction just a little bit, because there's one thing I want to hit and then we'll wrap it up. But I think that something that both of you two focus on a lot, perhaps in different ways, is sustainability in your food. Simon, you kind of do it via native ingredients a lot and have that perspective of, things that grow in Australia should be grown in Australia, and that sort of background of looking at what we've done to the land historically, and as you said, not using hooved animals for such a long time and things like that. How did you, and how have you sort of incorporated sustainability into your food, Louis? Because I know that, like, and it's a part of that sort of life experience thing, right? Like, having worked, in the public service and having an education, in a completely different field and things like that, it's like, so different experiences can allow you to look at things in different ways, and also allow you to be able to really meticulously, identify what's important when taking on a new project and things like that, and being able to work those into it. So, how'd you approach it?
I think one thing that sort of became central to the way I cooked. And it's not just to do with meat. It's just to do with seasonality. Like one of the first and the easiest things to do, I think, about sustainability in kitchens is cooking with seasons. If you're serving tomatoes in the middle of July, you know, you're not cooking local and you're not cooking seasonal. And it's not just about the sustainability aspect of that. The cost is going to be higher. The food miles on that are going to be massive because they're going to be coming from Mexico or Israel or something.
It'll be a fucking shit tomato.
Yeah, and it's going to be freaking terrible because it's spent so much time in cold storage. So not only are you hopefully going to be paying less money for, I mean, and this contradictory to what I said before, but hopefully you're going to be paying less for better produce that, you know, that's why I love the guys out of Brightside, Emily and Michael. I know that if I put an order in on Monday, I get stuff delivered on a Tuesday that was picked 6 hours before that. And it is, you can taste it. It's just so much better.
Mm.
And I think that's, for me, that's the easiest starting point. And from there, you can sort of snowball and get like down all these amazing rabbit holes, I think, of sort of in, like through Emily and Michael, for example, I met, I reckon, half a dozen other suppliers that are growing stuff locally and producing stuff that I, you know, I wouldn't have thought I would have been able to get easily or, you know, locally at all. And then when you start getting known for that kind of stuff, we used to have customers messaging on Instagram or whatever and saying like, hey, I've got a bag of this for my backyard. Do you guys want to use, you know, I've got 5 kilos of chestnuts. We had one customer come up and say, and you get to not only use those products, but you then get to sort of say, have a chat to some of them and you can influence in some ways what they're growing. And then you can sort of start to look at different components. Like rather than someone saying, okay, this coriander is about to go to flower, we want to chop it through. It's like, no, that's a product you can sell and I want to use. Working with producers becomes a second part of working seasonally. If you're working directly with the guys that are growing, producing, catching, farming, whatever, you're not going through multiple sources of, you know, supply chains. You're not adding food miles. You're not adding, you know, extra processes in there. You're working directly with them. You're getting the product exactly that you want and you're paying them the best possible price, which means that they can reinvest that in their business, which I find really, really important. The people in it, the sustainability of the people that are involved in, I think, those kinds of industries is also really, really important. But I'm obsessed with sort of native foods as well. And I think I'm trying to learn as much as I can about Ngunnawal.
Very diligent about your foraging as well, right?
And
learning that side of things too.
Yeah, and I love it. I mean, there's just so much in Canberra. It's one of the things that's the best thing about, I think it's probably for me the best thing about being a chef in Canberra is that 10 minutes from my house, I can be in the bush.
Mm.
I can be foraging in the state forest for mushrooms. I can be, you know, there's roadside like fennel everywhere.
You guys are much closer than mushrooms. Fucking 2.5 hour drive to get mushrooms.
It's incredible.
But like, we got the coast, so I'm pretty
sure. Yeah, fuck you. Actually, that is the one thing that drives me crazy about cooking in Canberra is seafood. It's so hard to get affordably and with good quality.
Yeah.
All the stuff we get at our markets comes from this, like half of it goes South Coast, Sydney Fish Markets, Canberra.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like,
oh, I mean, it's same in Wollongong. A lot of stuff will be fished South Coast, go to Sydney Market.
Through Wollongong
and back to us.
It's crazy.
Like, it's...
Like, the only way I've been able to get around that is a few of the guys that sell at some of the markets have their own boats and they'll only deliver once a week. But I know that when I get that delivery once a week, it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
Like we were getting 7 kilo kingfish off some guys that were still in rigor mortis. Like they were so fresh.
Mm.
Like seafood is the one thing we haven't been able to overcome easily in Canberra yet.
We were talking about earlier, like logistics with this stuff is, it makes up a massive thing, part of sustainability in Australia. Mm. And there's a lot of times there's no ways around it. It's a massive country. And you said like, you're in the main part of New South Wales, but you're still that far away from the coast. It's hard to get seafood.
Yeah.
So it becomes a massive problem. I was talking to Christian from Eurobingen earlier. He's starting to sort of grow some stuff, and we spoke to him about logistics, supply chains, and things. And I was telling him how, going forward, I really want to be able to secure fresh native fruits, because most of the time they come in frozen because they just snap frozen at the point of picking because they know it's got to travel or they know it's got to go somewhere. So it's hard to work like this, like to find the right people who can supply things on the right day with the right amount, again at the right price, all these things. It's not easy to try and be sustainably minded in the kitchen. It's tough, and you know, we ended up with like 25 suppliers for our ingredients. Mm. We'd, our butter would come from there, our cream would come from these guys. That one thing would come from there. Like it became a, like a massive task for us, and something we had to bring together and to kind of cut down on a little bit and fight our battles when we needed. Which is why when most chefs talk about it, I know they're fucking talking shit. Because it's fucking difficult.
Yeah, it's a choice you make, I guess, to sort of go, this is how we want to sort of source our restaurant. We want to make sure that what we're serving is good quality produce. And it's, you know, it's ethically sourced, it's ethically supplied, all that kind of stuff. If it's what, I mean, not every restaurant's going to do that. Not every restaurant's going to afford to do it. And I think it's really important to also not judge necessarily because it's better, I think, to bring people along by example, rather than sort of shaming them, if that makes sense. And that goes for like so many things in hospitality. But I think, I think when you were saying like a whole bunch of like people are full of shit, I reckon there's so much like smoke and mirrors when it comes to sustainability as a buzzword.
Yeah.
Like I remember a chef in Canberra was saying like, you know, we get 80% of our stuff locally and seasonally. And that is the upper limit of what you can achieve.
Yeah, exactly.
And what he was saying was like, you know, if someone says that they get all their onions grown locally, they're full of shit.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
No one in Canberra grows enough onions to be able to supply a restaurant for a week every week of the year.
Yeah.
Like,
it's like kitchen garden where we get all our herbs. Like, probably not.
No. You have a couple of pot plants at the front. The rest of it comes from a hydroponic farm in Western Sydney. Like, a lot of that stuff is for show. And it really bothers me that people use those kinds of catchphrases as a way to market themselves if they're not actually doing those things.
Yeah.
And again, being upfront and sort of, you know, we didn't get 100% of our stuff locally and seasonally. It's impossible to run a restaurant. If you were going to do that in Canberra, you'd close for 3 months of the year over winter because nothing grows down here. You can, you know, I'd like after a while, and like I love looking forward to winter because you've got great beetroots, you've got pumpkin, you've got cabbages, all that kind of stuff. But after 3 months of root vegetables, spring cannot come fast enough, I tell you what. But I think like beyond that as well, there's so much other stuff. Like the hoofed animal thing is something you've touched on really, really. I think it's really interesting and really important. Looking at the kinds of proteins from a fish, like the seafood point of view, like what we should and shouldn't be serving at restaurants.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, the damage to the environment, from both like agriculture and like the animals that we're raising and putting on the table, but also how we're using them. And we've talked about offal a couple of times, but making sure we're using as much of an animal as possible. Yeah. And for me,
every usable part.
Yeah, but it's like I never had the space at Kiosk or Rockford to start doing whole animal butchery, which is something I really want to get into. But what it means is if you, again, work closely with a butcher, you can figure out different cuts of meat you can use that are more cost effective for you.
Mm.
That, you know, butchers have so many secrets. They have so many secret cuts they never tell you about, the bastards. But when you find them out, if you start asking them about them, you can, from a restaurant, you can get lamb on the menu. We were able to get lamb on a menu for like $5.
Yeah, wow.
And that was after a month of trying different cuts and pricing it out. And then you come up with this cut, you're like, that's lean, that's tender, it's really tasty. And because it's such a pain in the ass to extract from the leg, it most of the time just ends up in sausages.
Yeah.
But if you say to them,
I'll take that part.
I'll pay that and I'll pay you a prime cut, not quite prime cut, because you can't afford like $42 a kilo to fill it. But it means that these cuts are actually getting like their time in the spotlight as well, rather than it has to be like a fillet or it has to be a scotch or whatever.
It's interesting to see.
Using a whole animal, like we previous owners, Crow, we used to buy whole cows. Mm. So we'd go to the from Gerhard down south. So they're pure blood Wagyu.
Wow.
Like pretty high marble score, although he'd be like, nah, it's a 9. And I'd be like, oh, this is like a 9. He's like, yeah, it's a chart. And I'd be like, if you say it's a 9, go, it's a 9. All right, whatever. But we kind of realized, one, there's a lot of mints, so we had some great staff lunches for those months. But when you got the whole cow, every cut costs you the same.
Yeah.
So like the fillet costs you the same amount as you know, something else. And we were doing a tasting menu. So it wasn't like we were charging more for each cut we were. So it was quite almost like humbling to see that, like, you know, doesn't really matter. Like I can choose the cuts I want to kind of use here. Rather than be like, customer loves the fillet, we love using this. It's like, we've got to use everything in different ways. And if people across the board started, you know, eating the whole of beef, the people who do love the fillet the most, well, they're going to get it for cheaper. But you've got to eat some brains.
Yeah. But I think that's where chefs play such a significant role in in working with butchers to find those cuts. And it's like, you know, you've got a financial incentive to find those cuts, to put them on your menus, and that's where they start becoming recognized and start being bought more broadly by the consumer. Like, I can't remember exactly the story, but I know that the Flatiron steak was discovered via a challenge for that was set by some, I think it was like a scientific institution or something like that, that was like, we want to find a cut of meat that is tender, flavorsome, and cheap. And because, you know, that part, like that shoulder, which is I believe where the Flatiron comes from, was kind of undiscovered. Like, so much of that, like, and it's before sort of different types of artisan butchery, was kind of like, people weren't bothering to take it apart because of the labor that was involved. People would find this Flatiron steak, but there's this huge bit of gristle that runs through the middle of it, and people just wouldn't put the effort in.
I mean, it would have been found before.
It was, I think, like, well, whatever. Like, anyway, like, these are the sorts of things that, like, put these cuts on the map and then get people understanding them, get people using them. And now you can buy Flatiron steaks at, like, probably Woolworths, Cotter. People know what they are.
Yeah, yeah.
You still struggle to find butchers that'll do that, I think, a lot of the time.
Labor.
I think, and that's another thing, like, the cultural differences as well. Like, I did an event like this week, actually, cooking out on a farm for some friends, and we were doing rump cap or picanha. It's like a Brazilian cut. You cannot find a local butcher that'll do that, because in their point of view, because they're trained in Australian butchery techniques.
You can find a strip of the rump cap is on each rump steak that you can.
Yeah, like, but when you get a whole thing together,
it's one of my favorite cuts.
Yeah,
rump is like, it's a ridiculous cut to cut in a steak like that. Like, if you delineate and take those like three main muscles off. You got even more than that. You got that little cap. You got this little bit on the like, again, like to the point where I don't even know the names of something. There's like one little bit on the side. Like, looks like a little bit of a fillet of the rump, and that little piece is delicious. Like, I used to buy whole rumps in and take them apart, and then throughout the night, there was a bit of a fuck around because I had like four different types of steak to cook for customers throughout the night, and they'd be like, okay, I've got a table of four, right, cool, I'll use that little bit. I'm like, oh, he's getting a treat because that's a great little part. And like rumps are just a very interesting cut on its own.
I think, like, you go to France, you go to Italy, you go to South America, they all butcher differently.
Much more seen butchery. Like, here it's very much the large cuts. France, in England a bit more recently as well. Seam butchery, where you're taking each individual part off, and that's how you find those interesting.
And when you discover those cuts, you're like, holy crap, that's delicious. Tender. Anyway,
there is an absolute world we can talk about when it comes to sustainability. And I just think that, like, in general, things seem to be moving in a more positive direction.
I think so.
I think we're like, we also have to acknowledge the bubble that we all live in, having our fingers on the pulse of what's happening in modern food culture. But, you know, I mentioned it when we were talking today in another podcast we did, but like, Josh Nyland was on MasterChef butchering a kingfish. And that goes out to everyone from us. I don't watch MasterChef, but people from chefs that are interested to Nan and the kids, like my niece who's 8 years old loves MasterChef. Surely that sort of, you know, lauding people like Josh Nyland for their focus on sustainability and showing these new techniques of butchery and being able to use different components and things like that is going to filter down, and we're moving in a positive direction. Same goes for whole vegetable butchery, if you want to call it that, you know, whole seafood butchery, whole animal butchery, whatever you call it. That's a good one.
Some pat of peach.
There was awesome. A veggie butcher that opened up in Newtown, I think.
Oh, right. There's one that's opened in the UK.
Okay.
They sold out like in like 2 hours in London somewhere.
Interesting.
So vegetable butchery is the next thing.
I'm going to start wrapping it up, guys, because we're going over what we normally do. But Louis, what's... I mean, we're in COVID and all sorts of things, but like, what's next for you? Have you got anything happening? Anything like still looking for a permanent space and working towards that?
Yeah, I'm looking in a few places. I'm not busting the gut trying to find somewhere now because it's still very strange times. I've got a couple of lines on a few sites and chatting to some real estate agents, but I don't want to jump into anything unless I know it's right. In the meantime, I'm helping out a chef at a new place, new venue that's opened up in the city. He does Singaporean hawker food.
Amazing.
Cool. Yeah, he's doing some really cool stuff. So I just help him on the weekends, sort of when they're sort of super busy. But what I'm doing this week, I'm actually really enjoying. There's some guys that have a knife school out on the Murrumbidgee, And I do a lot of work with veterans and people from the police force who've sort of had pretty traumatic experiences. And this week they're doing a prototype, I guess, of a course where they're teaching retired vets. They're ranging some of these guys from their sort of, I'd say, mid to late 20s up until guys that are sort of maybe probably in their 70s. Mm. These guys have all seen some pretty rough things during service. And all this research about sort of finding things about, you know, learning to technical skills and working with your hands to give you some focus and purpose is a really good way of healing and sort of developing wellness and happiness and that kind of thing. And this week they're teaching them on one day how to make a knife, another day to build a barbecue, and another day how they're making a leather apron. And they then have someone on the fourth day teaching them how to use the equipment that they've made and cook over fire. So I went out and did a day on Monday. There's another chef doing today and yesterday, and I'm going out tomorrow.
And that's out at Cup of Cumberland.
Yeah. So Cup of Cumberland, the Thower Valley Forge guys. So it's a really great project supported by the Department of Veterans Affairs. So I think there's 16 people on this course this week. So I just basically get four of them for a day, and I have to sort of teach them different sort of techniques about cooking over fire. So we're trying to build their confidence, not just sort of chuck some woolly sausages and douse them in VB like we always used to do when we're like 14 or whatever. But that kind of stuff I'm really enjoying, like teaching these guys sort of different kind of ways of cooking at home or when they go camping or whatever, not just like some bog standard kind of gear. Like we're trying to really sort of give them something special to take home with this. And that kind of thing I'm keen to keep doing in the meantime. But I think opening a
Hello,
little
dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or The Food Fight Podcast at gmail.com.
If we want to hear from you, we want to talk to you, that sort of stuff. No more lockdowns. No more lockdowns.
Contact tracing is in. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans.
Mate, it's an interesting story.
Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll catch you again with another episode.
To a lot of chefs and stuff out there. And, you know, I think you come from such a different background that it affords you an ability to look at things in different ways as well. So, it's been a pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for joining us, and keep it up. We look forward to catching up when you've got somewhere of your own.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Cheers, mate. Thanks, mate.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.